So we're talking about R square here as an overfitting issue.
The adjusted usually goes down.
The adjusted always goes down. Yeah. It's designed to go down. It's a formula. Right? And have you ever looked inside or seen the structure of the formula for adjusted R square? What do you think is in it? So the R square, you know what it is. It's y minus, it's the R squared is it 1 minus the residual sum of squares as a fraction or something like that?
Yeah.
So what's the adjusted one then? It always goes down.
They include degrees of freedom, so I forget the
number. Yeah, exactly. And what else is in it? Which degrees of freedom?
I think
the error degrees of freedom are in it. Exactly. And the model degrees of freedom are in it as well. Oh, yeah, exactly. So if the ratio of model degrees of freedom, how many parameters in the model to how many are left, if that ratio is big, then you have a huge drop in the, if you use up most of your degrees of freedom to make the model, right? Then the R square adjusted is going to drop enormously. And it's basically telling you there's a good chance you've overfitted. Right? The simplest example of it, the whole thing, is here. Suppose you have two data points. Right? Just two data points. How many parameters does it take to fit a line to two data points? How many parameters does it take to make a line for two data points? Two. In fact, you use them all up. And of course, you'll get a perfect fit, right? You get a perfect fit. So the two. So now the epsilons are zero. So the R square is what here?
One.
But all right, apply that to a new data set with two data points. What's likely to happen? Do you think it'll be the same again? You know, it won't. It'll be different. You know, the new data point will be here, and the other one will be here. See what I mean? So you pick the best one, so of course it has to regress. This is also called regression to the mean. Because you pick the best. You deliberately got the best. Anytime you do that, you're capitalizing on chance. See, you can also call this capitalizing on chance. So it looks very good, you trained it to the data that you did, so of course it looks good, you evaluated on the same data you did. Yeah. So the adjusted R squared then will say, come on, if you use all your degrees of freedom to do that, expect a big drop the next time. If you only use 4 degrees of freedom out of 100, then no big deal. Right? It's pretty, you probably didn't overfit. Right? So that's the idea of it. So it's a way internally of working out what the... It's basically a way of looking at what it would be in a new data set without having to do a new data set. So it's a conceptual idea, right? But the best way, I think, is to do it on a new data set and convince yourself that it still holds up or it doesn't hold up, right? Yeah. So all of your ones, when you were doing the training, when you were doing the 75% performance on past data sets, Parajash and the rest of them, what were you... Isn't that what you were telling me, that you were getting about 75% performance? Was that applying it on its own data? When you were... some of you had in your...
Oh, yeah.
That was on your own data set.
Yeah.
So you see what I mean? You probably should come down a bit and say, it won't be as good as that in a new data set. That's the idea of an adjusted R score. Yeah. By the way, one other thing. It's tricky because the degrees of freedom concept changes from... setting to setting, but in regular regression, I'm just talking about Y continuous, and you have multiple regression and so on, not logistic and that's trickier, but in regular regression, you have Y and a bunch of X's, and what's the idea of a degree of freedom? I mean, I know you know how to calculate it, it's N minus the number of fitted parameters, but what's a way to think about it? You know, instead of saying that to somebody, oh, it's N minus the number of parameters. So what's that about? What are degrees of freedom? What are they?
Unused information.
Hmm?
The information that is unused.
Unused information, yeah. But what, okay. But, good. But what's it used for then? It's not that it's unused. It is used.
Yeah.
Or you should use it. And how should you use it?
Independent.
Huh?
Independent.
No, but do you, because basically, isn't it also how many independent residuals you have left now? It's how many independent residuals there are. Isn't that true? There's no independent residuals here. If I take this data point here, how many, and now I fit this one, how many degrees of freedom have I left for error now? Here, in this one. So n is 3, k is 2, or p is 2, right? So degrees of freedom 1. What does that mean? What does it mean? Well, yeah, but up here, when I had these, I had no way of knowing what was going to happen next. I have no way of assessing error here, do I? At all. So I have no way to tell what could happen. Because the data fit perfectly. At least here, I have one independent residual. It's only one. And I can square that, or add up all three, but they have only one degree of freedom between them, and use that as an estimate of what? What do you do with the residuals?
Residual variance.
Huh?
Variance.
You estimate the residual variance. You estimate variance. Yeah. So residuals are used to estimate variance. They are the sigma hat squared, is the sum of the squared residuals divided by the degrees of freedom, isn't it? Mean square error, isn't it? Yeah, that's what you use. So mean square error is a very important concept everywhere. The idea of how much is, on average, is the error state, right? So a degree of freedom is an independent assessment of error. And so if you have 5 degrees of freedom left, it means you have 5 independent estimates of how much error there is still in the model. So think of it as number of independent assessments of error, right? A degree of freedom. Independent assessments of error. Right? It's a useful way to think about regression. So you need degrees of freedom, because otherwise, if you use them all to build a model and have nothing left to judge the error, then how can you say anything, right? So that's why we want to keep a good few degrees of freedom for error. At least, I would say you want to keep at least 30 or 40 if you can in a model. After that, it probably doesn't matter, because once you have 30 or 50 or 100 independent residuals, you know, having another 1,000 probably won't help, won't tighten things a lot, right? But that's the key. Now, what's tricky, and the reason this is tricky to talk about degrees of freedom, is there's degrees of freedom at another level as well, two other levels. There's degrees of freedom, for example, when we had the 4 groups in the psychology experiment about women and math, we had 4 groups, right? So how many degrees of freedom did we have there? And now I'm thinking degrees of freedom in a different sense, but in contrast. So that's how many independent contrasts you can make. So if you had 4 groups, you have 3 independent contrasts you can do. Some people think of that as degrees of freedom as well. That's the degrees of freedom on the treatment side, or on the group, on the model side, right? But there's those on the model side, and the others are on the residual side. So that's a different way of looking at degrees of freedom there, but everyone understands that as well. I am right now trying to work out, my R is still here, and do it. I'm trying to work it out. Last night I was trying to do this. I have to work out space. Do you see that from the back? Yeah. There have been two trials of cancer screening for lung cancer screening. The first one, which is the first number in the vector, is in the US. And in the US study, they had three rounds of screening. An initial round of screening, and then two more rounds a year later and 2 years later. And in the second study in the Netherlands and Belgium, they had four rounds of screening, spaced out a bit further. Right? So in the first study, the why is averted, is there was 90 fewer deaths in the screening arm compared to the non-screening arm. 90 fewer deaths from lung cancer. So that means that the screening, as best we can tell, best point estimate, is that it removed 90 lung cancer deaths, or cure. You might think of them as cures, I'm not sure. 90 saved by, and it's based on 25,000 people being screened three times, right? So you can divide the 90 by 75,000 to find out, or just divide it by 75, and that will say, for every 1,000 screens, how many deaths averted? So if you just do 90 divided by 75, because it's 25,000 three times, 90 divided by 75 is 1.1 or 1.2. So it's 1.2 deaths averted for every 1,000 screens, and that's a very useful number because now people can do the cost effectiveness. Because 1,000 lung cancer screens is how much money would you say as a physician? And these are CT, low-dose CT, plus a whole lot of other workups and so on. It's not $50 a CT, is it?
No.
No, it's more like $500 probably. And if you're down in the US, it's probably $2,000, right?
Or
so it's
4,000.
Huh?
Around 4,000 for each screen.
For a
in the US, at least.
Yeah, that's right. And if you have insurance, yeah. If you don't, forget it. Exactly. So, but in Quebec, they're talking about doing it now. And so they have to do cost. You know, is it worth? Is this going to be worth it? Because one of the very simple things to work out in cost effectiveness in medicine and in public health is the cost per one life year extended. It's a very useful measure in it. And the reason it's so useful is that the public has already agreed that certain procedures are cheap enough that we will do them. And the one that's most easy to think about is kidney dialysis. In kidney dialysis, if you don't have it, you'll be dead. If you have it, you'll probably stay alive. Right? So a year of dialysis keeps a person alive for 1 year. Right? So dialysis is... So if you work out how much does it cost to have one person on dialysis for a year... You're saving your life. You're extending that life by a year. Any sense of that? Any sense of how much it costs per person per year of dialysis?
Yeah.
Huh? Any idea at all? It used to be, when I got into this business maybe 20 years ago on screening, it was about $30,000. So now it's about probably $50,000 to keep a person alive for a year in dialysis. Okay? And the public has accepted that that's good. We'll do that. If it were $1 million to keep you alive for an extra year, I doubt that you could get that done. You know, nobody would pay for that. No public would pay for that. If you're a millionaire, you can do it, but for asking the public to pay for you $1 million to keep you alive for a year, so this metric is used a lot. And when new drugs come on and new this and they extend life by this much, it is the metric. Who worked with Nandini? Was it you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you guys use those methods for life year extended? Because that's how screening is usually worked out. Yeah.
Yeah. I think they are like similar things, but
Yeah. It's all about How much does it cost to, you know, to save one thing? And nothing is free. Nothing is neutral. There's always a cost. Yeah. So anyhow, this is what we're trying to work out now. So I was, at the beginning, when there was only the U.S. trial, I said 90 deaths removed by 75,000 screens. So that's a very easy number. What do you think is the objection I'm going to get if I say to people, this is a very easy calculation to do, 75,000 screens saved 90 lives, it's 90 divided by 75, that's the number saved per 1,000 screens. From a cancer screening point of view, what objection could you see to that? Why is that overly simplistic? And this is now about cancer screening. And none of you have had much, you have any experience with cancer screening? Have you been talked about it in courses or anything? It's kind of a special thing, because what happens is on the first screen, let's say these are all smokers, by the way, and on the first screen, high-risk smokers will be screened. Right? And then, they, if they're found, cancers found there will be treated, so they're treated early. Right? Then, a year later, the ones who still haven't got cancer will be screened again. And a year later, they'll be screened again. So, can you see why there's a, why it might not be fair to make every screen have the same benefit? Because I'm assuming that all three screens have the same benefit. Right? The first screen, the second screen, the third screen. Do you think the three screens in cancer would have the same benefit? If you go for the first time screening people, in lung cancer, what are you going to find? Let's say you're doing it with a chest x-ray in the old days. Yeah.
Well, some of them will be ruled as possible cancer cases.
Huh?
Some of them will be picked as cancer.
Yeah, yeah, you will find cancer.
Yeah.
You will find cancer that hasn't, that they don't know about yet.
Yeah.
And especially lung cancer, you don't know about it until too late. So the whole idea is to find it early. Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. But when they did this with this was the conundrum. When they did this in New York for the first time with CT screening, CT is much fancier than an x-ray. The old method was x-ray. And what they found in 1,000 people, high-risk people in New York, the first time they did it, is that the x-ray found 8 cancers, 7 or 8. The CT found 27. So what does that tell you about CT versus x-ray? X-ray is very crude. It doesn't find, it's kind of rough. You can't see very well in an X-ray. The CT has a much better resolution, and it found 27. A lot of them, you couldn't have even seen them on the X-ray. So people were very excited about that, and it was the base, that was the basis, actually, for starting the lung cancer trial. To see, they compared it. In fact, lung, chest X-rays compared to nothing, it's not much better than nothing. There was an old study from Mayo Clinic from 40 years ago that says that chest x-ray screening for lung cancer wastes the time. It doesn't do anything. It's so crude that you're no further ahead. You don't find them early enough and so on. But CT looked very promising. The advocates were saying they were going to cure, find 90% of the cases early, and now we're going to cure lung cancer quickly because we can find it on time. So that was the logic. Well, here's the trial. And the trial was, what you don't know here is an, in this trial, there were about 400, I think, deaths in the first 7 years in the group that didn't get the CT screening, and 90 less than that in the group that did. So the 90 was a reduction of about 20%, whatever that is. So it was 20%, 90 is 20%, so 450. So there were 450 deaths in this group that were not screened with CT. Right? And 90 less than that, so 20% less in the group that did get the CT. So it's a 20% reduction is how it was pushed after six years. After 10 years, they stopped the screening. After 10 years, it's still a difference of 90 cases. So all the benefit was realized at the beginning. It's not like it saved people who are going to die at year 9 or 10. So we have a 90 benefit from 75,000 screens. Right? The problem is,
that the first cases, they're very, very, will they be more advanced than the cases you get in the second screen? Or will they be less advanced?
Yeah, more advanced.
They'll be more advanced. Why?
Because like you haven't picked them up until then.
Yeah, you didn't do anything. For now, they could be ready to kill you tomorrow, and you can only find them, right? But probably after the first one, you've taken out the really big ones now, so you're starting with the small ones again for next year. So they've only a year to get to that point from before, if whatever, right? So the idea is that the first one is a very bad mix because a lot of them you're not going to be able to do much with. But the idea is then, once they're out of there, the second screen should now do much better. Isn't that right? I think. That's the logic, right? So I think when this first trial came out, I was saying to people, they did very fancy models, and I'm saying, look guys, it's very simple arithmetic, 90 divided by 75. That's the ratio of how many prevented, whatever. If I knew, nobody would listen to me. Now what has happened is we have a second trial from the Netherlands. Much smaller, not 25,000 people screened, but 10,000 people screened. Sorry, 10,000 men in the study, 6,000 were screened and 6,000 were not. Sorry, 12,000. 6,000 were screened, 6,000 were not. Right? But there was four screens instead of three. Right? Until then, just with my 90, I couldn't tell how much better the second and third screens were than the first one, right? Because I don't know enough. I have only 90, and it's a mix of cures from the first screen plus cures from the other two screens. But then the light went on Monday morning here as I was walking up the street, and I said, oh my God, with the new one now, we have in the Nelson trial, the one in Europe, we have one screen plus three additional screens, right? So now, and it saved 50 lives, okay? So what are my equations now? I'm trying to solve now for the effect of the first screen, and then the other screens have a different, so it's like beta 1 times the first screen, 25,000 times beta 1, plus 50,000 times beta 2, right? Because that's 50,000 screens in year 2 and 3, right? And then the other one is 6,000 beta 1 plus 15 or 18,000 beta 2, and that should equal this. So you see what I'm doing here? I'm basically saying that that's the equation, right? That 90 is a linear combination of a beta 1 and a beta 2. It's a linear combination of the beta 1 and beta 2, isn't it? And the 50 is a linear combination with the same betas, but different x's, of the other design. Right? And when I did it, so what have I got now? I have two data points, two y's, and what do I want to fit? Two betas. One beta refers to what the first screen does, how much good it does, and the second beta is how much the other screens do, assuming they're all interchangeable at that point. But they're not the same as the ones, and I expect that the beta 1 indeed is a smaller number. It's not as good a benefit as the second one. Yeah, because the second one you're dealing with smaller ones, you have a chance to catch them early that you didn't have on the other one. So anyway, I realized this is better than having no degrees of freedom. I now have two observations and two unknowns. I'm going to solve them. And I tried to solve them, and I got a negative beta for one and a positive beta for the other. It didn't make any sense. This was at 4 o'clock last night. On the way home, I was thinking about it, and I realized that's the wrong thing to do. Because what's really happening is that the American trial, screened here, here, and here. This is at 0, 1, and 2. They screened here and then they followed for 10 years. The European trial screened here at 3
and at 5.5, I think. Right? So they had four screens, but they're here. So this regime applied to 25,000 produced 90 deficit, right? So there's 25,000 going into this, and there's 6,500 going into this, right? 25,000. But what I'm interested in this beta 1, and then I'm interested in the beta 2, which is what the effect of subsequent screens is. But what's the big benefit of the second design? Even if they had only the same number of screens, even if they each had three screens, if this wasn't there, or this wasn't there, let's say you took this one out. So now you have three screens as well, to keep it equal. Which is the more efficient design, or a more efficient strategy?
Probably more spread out. Because if you didn't catch it at zero, then it might take longer to show up.
Yeah. You were basically, this is a surveillance system, or a watching system, that's there, and it has covered, this one has covered 5.5 years.
Yeah.
So, and I thought about it, I said, my God, it's not the number of screens that matter, it's how much time you could, because there's no benefit after here.
Yeah.
The last screen was here. The last screen is here, so it's got to be worth twice as much. So the real measure is time covered by the screens. Do you agree? Yeah.
Time between the screens.
Not even. The total time covered by... Well, from the first to the last, here is 2 years. So I was only watching for 2 more years. So the benefit would come... I'm doing very, very roughly now. For 2 more years, there's a benefit for that population. But beyond that, you can't have benefit. So it's years of putting... You know, whatever. But the other one, it's 5. Right? Now, where you spread them, it's a little tricky, but nevertheless, it's at least double the other one. You following me, Jesse?
Yeah.
Yeah. So now I'm saying to myself, what's the metric now? The metric here is this. First screen's 25,000 and 5.5. So there'll be a beta 1 for that and a beta 1 for that. Right? So the beta 1 gets applied to these, right? Because they're first screens, and I expect that to be a poor beta. The second one is the subsequent screens, but they're not screens, they're years. Right? This is 50 because it's 25,000 people followed for 2 years. You see? So it's 50,000 years of screen that you were doing, because you came back at the end of the second year, so you basically have covered all cancers that could have come up in that time, right? But in the other one, this is 6,000 people, but 5.5 years. You following me? Because it's basically how much you've covered. It's like you put a net out or something. This is using a much bigger time net than the other one, so it's got to do better. So now, but I'm really stuck here. I'm stuck because this is 2 data points, 2 parameters. My 2 y's are 90 and 50. And my 2 parameters that I want, beta 1, the effect of the first round of screening, and beta 2, the effect of one extra of a year of screening. Right? The effect of a year of screening. Right? But I have, in some of them it's 5.5, and the other one it's 2. So can I fit this? I can, but I have no degrees of freedom left because I fit 2 degrees of freedom to 2 y's. But I tell you, it's way better than nothing. That's I'm going to push. So I'm trying to compose the letter. The Nelson trial only came out about 2 weeks ago in the New England Journal. There's going to be all sorts of complaints and things about why are the results different in Europe versus this. They got a 22% reduction, we got a 17% or whatever, whatever. A lot of fuss, the Americans would all be complaining that the European trial wasn't well done, we don't understand all the methods. They don't like the idea that they got a 24% reduction and the Americans only got 20 or 18. But to me, I think they're missing the point. You know, from a cost-effectiveness point of view, a reduction of 20% or 18% is not telling the full story. For a cost-effectiveness thing, you want to know how many deaths prevented per 1,000 screened. That wasn't in the abstract. It was in the other one, but not in the Nelson one. They just gave rate ratios and rate... Well, if you give a rate difference, you're sort of doing it. So anyway, what do you think the answer is here? So I was lazy to solve two equations and two unknowns. That shouldn't be hard, but I've forgotten how to... Well, I did do it by hand, actually. It was easy enough. And it was easy because you could multiply 6 1/4 by 4 and you could subtract one equation from the other and get it out directly. It was very easy. Yeah. But anyway, this is the same idea here, right? So it's a linear model. So I'm regressing the 90 and the 50. And now, this is, I want a beta 1 for the first screen and a beta 2 for the subsequent years of screening, right? And you see what I'm doing? If I only put this in, what would happen? It would mess up. I have to force this to have no intercept. I have no degrees of freedom for an intercept. See? I'm down to the smallest you can do. So, what do you think the answers are? Anyone do it by hand?
Shouldn't be too much.
Huh?
6.5 times 5.5? Or?
Well, what I did is, it turns out that there's not everybody gets the second and third and fourth screens. I didn't know. They have in the paper the numbers that got second, third, and fourth, because some people will have died by the time the second screen comes up. These are not great patients because they have heart disease and all sorts of other things caused by their smoking. They're high-risk patients, so they're a little trickier, right? But it doesn't matter. I should probably put 6.5. Keep everything simple. If I use 25 here, I should probably use it again here. 50, yeah. Because I assumed here that all 50,000 would be screened again. It's a few less than that. First, the cancers are taken out. There's a few cancers, maybe one cancer per 100 or per 1,000 taken out. But other people are dying as well. But this is so rough that I just am probably going to put it in as it is. Yeah, it won't change things. Hey, what's still happening here? Yeah, so you can see this? So those are my beta 1 hat and my beta 2 hat, right? So this is for every 1,000 first screens, less than a case helped, which kind of makes sense, and for... This is for every year screened, right? Or every year that you have coverage, do you give the population by screening? And I'm not getting into the numbers, whatever it is. Right? So that's the best I can. But I'm now trying to say to people, you know, I'm going to write this as a letter to the New England Journal and say, this is what you guys should be doing. Stop your rate ratios and the other things. And so I'm trying to put this in a way everyone will understand, and I'm hoping I can. But I know there'll be objections from all the theoretical people. I have no standard error on it. I have no anything. Can I get standard errors on these? Certainly not from internally. I cannot do it. Right? I don't think. At least they're coming out in the order I expect. In the, you know, that the first one is smaller than the second one. Can you think of any way to get a standard error? If the New England Journal says, I won't publish this until you give me a standard error, or at conference. Have you ever seen a case where you have no degrees of freedom left, you use the full ones, and yet you can get standard error? And you have, but you haven't thought about it.
Is it like zero?
Huh?
Zero standard error?
Technically, yes.
Yeah,
but you see, technically, yes, but I mean, I don't, but it's not right. Because the 90 is itself just a statistical variant, right? If somebody else had done this trial in a slightly different place, they wouldn't have gotten 90. They might have gotten 85 or 104, you know what I mean? Right?
Here there's no intercept, so wouldn't there be a difference, like the line would have perfectly go through your 2 points.
The lines are going through the intercept here.
But we don't have an intercept. through 7 as well.
Sorry, they're going through 0. I mean, they're going through 0.
Yeah, so like 0 is technically a point.
It is a point. It is a point. Yeah.
So then you would have a... It's not a... Like, it's technically a third point.
Yes, it is. It is a third point. So then I agree with you. Yeah.
So you have a degree of freedom, technically.
I see where you're going. Yeah, I kind of see where you're going. Yeah. Like, let's go back a minute. To the one, let's say the simple model, where I had just the American trial, and I had 90 deaths divided by 75,000 screens. Right? So let's say I put my one number summary, which is screening in the US per screen, it's 190 over 75, whatever that is, 18 over 15, 6 over 5, 1.2 or whatever it is, it's 1.2 prevented per. Could you get a conference and refer that? That's a simpler case, and it's the same idea.
Is that the bootstrapping?
Hmm?
Is that the bootstrapping?
So you have 90 divided by... Your slope is basically 90 over 75, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's 90 over 75 is your slope, because you write it from 0 up to 90, and you have 75 across, right? Yeah, so it's 90 over 75. So you're stuck again, you use your degree of freedom to estimate the slope, so you have no residual left. So now what would you do? You have to get some error on the 90 first, somehow. The 75 is a given, that's a constant. The X is a constant, right? 75,000 screens, that's what it was, right? The point is the 90, what plus and minus do you have on the 90? Because whatever plus and minus you have on the 90, that then gets divided by 75. That's the confidence interval. Right? So now the question is, what would the standard error be on 90? Well, question should be, where did you get the 90? What's 90? How did you get it? Remember I told you how I got it. It was 450 minus 360, wasn't it? It was 450 deaths in the arm that didn't get the screening, minus 360 deaths in the arm that did get the screening. You agree with me? Does that help you? You see, this is so basic that you guys can't do anything because you don't have the computer, you can't, you know what I mean? You're stuck at this point. But you're having to think out of the box here. Isn't it? Huh? So the 90 is a difference, yeah, of what kind of random variables would you say? Roughly. It's simplest. What would be the random variable, the name of the random variable, the Riemann distribution that describes the 450 deaths in the unscreened arm?
Binomial.
It's binomial. Why don't we make it quiet? It's 450 out of 25,000. You can make it Poisson as well, because it's so close, right? So you can make the 450 a realization from a Poisson random variable, right? And you can make the 360 from the screen group another Poisson random variable. Therefore, what's the variance on the difference? The sum of the variances. The variance of the difference is the sum of the variance because they're independent arms, right? And so how much does that come to? What's the variance?
The mean.
It's the mean, so what is it? So you have...
some means.
So it would be... and the variance we said is 450 plus 360, isn't it? And the square root of that, right, should be the variance of the 90. Isn't that right? Yeah, so the variance of the 90 should be the sum of the two variances, and you put in the plug-in mu as this because we're using Poisson random variable.
So the 90 has a plus and minus of 28 on it. All right? The 90 has a plus and minus of 28 on it. So, when we're finished, then we can basically say, here are our equations, but I guess I'll have to do the same. Well, if I was only doing this, yeah, it would be 90 plus and minus 2 of those divided by 75 would be my confidence interval for those. Right? That was for the one sample problem where I just had the US trial. But now I have to put two variances into the other one. It's a little more complicated. I'll have to figure out how to do it. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to say, look, guys, this is the best you're going to get. You're lucky to get this. Right? But this is how you should be thinking about it, and whenever you make recommendations as to whether it should be screened or how much benefit, because the point of this is that this trial is artificial. This is the point I was making at the seminar in EPI about 3 months ago. These screening trials do not represent what would happen in real life. In Quebec, if we're going to do lung cancer screening, or in the US they've started already and paying for it, the lung cancer screening will be a program. And they'll probably say, starting at age 50, if you have X number of pack years of smoking, you're eligible to be screened. And then we will screen you, we'll say, every year, every 2 years after that. Probably until you're 70. Right? So the screening program will not be 2 years, 0, 1, and 2 only. It will be 0 plus maybe 19 years more. So the benefit of 19 years of screening, or plus the first one, would be that first number plus 20. See? Plus that. So it's a completely different thing. Right now, this 90 over 75 is just based on one initial and two follow-ups. And the two follow-ups are the good ones. But if you have one initial and 19 extras, you have a new way to do the calculations. Right? And that's the real story. And once you get past the bad one at the beginning, that's when the benefit shows up. So it's being very diluted at the moment by mixing one screen at the beginning with only two screens afterwards. But that's what people are doing. People are really not thinking about this properly. So anyway, that's my example of 2 degrees of freedom, two all spent estimating the two parameters. So I'm really at the edge here. But when you use this model that we talked about, like with the 90 over 75 in this, there's a name for that kind of standard error. And it's important, an important name. No? It's pooled, but what is it what's behind this? Where did I get the variance of 450 from? And where did I get the variance of 360 for the other one? I didn't get that from the data. Where did I get those two variances from to make the standard error? Because, Jesse, it wasn't in the data, right? That was not in the data. I had to use extra things, and I had to say, remember, if we think about this as models, what's the model? Oh, Poisson or binomial? So there's a name for this kind of standard error. Model-based standard error. This is a model-based standard error, isn't it? I had to make the assumption that these two random variables were Poisson. Is it a reasonable assumption? Probably not bad, right? But it's model-based. It came from outside. It did not come from the raw data, Jesse. So if you didn't know anything about Poisson distributions and the names of the variances and all that before, there was no way you were going to be able to get the 90 over 70, the plus and minus of 28, right? Yeah, so it's model-based. Whereas if you have enough degrees of freedom, the data will give you the standard error. And there's a name for that kind of standard error. Empirical standard error. Robust standard error. Database standard error. You've had these expressions in other names in other courses. Where, typically? Where did you find?
When you're talking about the sandwiches, that's another way of dealing. That's just called, it's a database standard error when you're using sandwich or empirical standard error or something like that. Model-based standard errors are very dangerous. Because if the model isn't right, and very often people make a model that's too, with variances that's too tight. So, you're much better off having the data tell you what the standard error is rather than the model. But sometimes you have no choice. And the place where you have no choice is if you have no degrees of freedom for estimating the error, then you're stuck with, if you can get it at all, a model-based standard error. Right? So part of it was your slope is the 0 going to 90 and the 0 going to 60, the 90 over 75, whatever it was, 90 over 75. That was part of it, but the fact that the model is what gives you the variance on the 90. Right? Yeah. So that's a model-based standard error. Right? But you see this a lot. Where, I'm trying to think where it comes up the most in your regression courses.
That's that, maybe.
I don't think they care. They do, but I mean in application, in data sets. And what kind of regression does it come up in? And when do people say to you, you should probably use the model-based standard error? Not the model-based, the empirical standard error. The robust standard error, the sandwich estimator, the whatever. What those particular kind of courses where that comes up. And it's usually tacked on at the end of the regular regression course. If you're lucky and in a regular regression course, they get to this thing called mixed models or hierarchical models, where the effect isn't the same for everybody. So you have this extra variation because of clusters or, I'm trying to think where the other examples are. Random intercepts, random slopes, you know all that stuff? Who's had courses on that?
That's advanced GLM,
yeah. It's linear models, but with this extra thing that there's extra variation because you have the same pressure measured four times and a different person, and you have clusters, and so they're what they're doing is they're introducing extra variation. And if you assume that's not there, then your standard errors are too small. So the model-based GE is another place where it's used, where you have clustered data or correlated data. Correlated data is another course where you would have this. Right? So that's where this comes up most, right? Is empirical standard errors or robust standard errors. It comes up in sampling sometimes too, when you're not sure. A very good example, a beautiful example, in Cochrane's book on sampling. Really easy example to think about. Cochrane was a professor of statistics at Harvard. He has some kind of chi-square statistic named after him. But he also wrote a very good book, and he was still at Hopkins when he wrote the book. And in his data set, he has a little survey from Baltimore, where Hopkins is, a household survey. And it's very, very simple, but really clear. In this household survey, he has only data from 30 houses. And in the house, he has a certain number of people, each house, adults. I think he had how many adults in the house, and then how many of those saw a doctor in the last year. So the question is, how many Americans see a doctor in the last year? So he has a sample of 30 houses. And he finds out, and maybe in those 30 houses, there's 75 adults. 75 adults, right? And let's say of the adults, 40 of 75 adults have seen a doctor in the last year. Okay? You with me? So now the question comes up, whatever 40 over 75 is, what proportion is that? Let's say you report it as a proportion, and now what confidence interval will you put on that? So you went to 30 houses, you found 75 adults, you asked them each, have you seen a doctor in the last year? And you find 40 out of 75 say yes. Can you now say that it's 40 over 75 is your p-hat,
and that your standard error is p hat 1 minus p hat over root of 70 over 75, square root of all that. Huh?
No, you need to...
be careful. So it's p hat is whatever. P hat 1 minus p hat over 75, square root of that. Yes or no? Is that okay? You don't agree. Why don't you agree?
Because I don't know the exact formula.
But no, I agree. But instinctively, why are you worried?
Yeah, because I feel people in the same household are more likely to kind of like have the same information.
It's not about have the same information. You mean we give the same response? You mean?
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yes.
So, they will or they won't? You said the people in the same house will what?
Will have that information are more likely to be related to each other.
So? Yeah, I think you're on the right track, but keep going.
So you need to account for that...
Yeah, so what's she getting at there? They're correlated. They're correlated. They could be correlated. Right? If I asked you how many of them had blue eyes, what would you think?
Most likely all of them.
All of them, maybe. I don't know. In Baltimore. We should get Donald Trump asking here what he thinks about it. He's made lots of comments about Baltimore. It all depends on what the variable is, right? It all depends on the variable. If I ask how many of them are smokers, would you be worried? How many of them are smokers? We got 40 smokers out of 75. They're not independent. So I don't think we have 75 independent people. If we went out on the street and found 75 people at random and used them, I could use the binomial. But because we have 30 clusters of two or three each, and if they were giving identical answers, we might only have 30 binomials, 30 Bernoulli. Right? Let's say I ask them, how many of you have a car? And they talk about the same car. Then obviously it's only 30 people out of whatever for the house, right? Or something like that. Or have you got internet? If I ask each, have you got internet at home? And I ask the 75, but it's the same internet for both of them, or the three of them, then obviously they're not independent. So there I have an N of 30 now. And I should only use the 30. If it was something else, it depends how correlated those two things are, right? And so you can actually use the data to get a proper standard error for that, right? Because you can see how correlated they are in the data and work it out. And if it was like an internet question, it would very clearly tell you, unless one of them gave the wrong answer and they didn't agree, but you should basically be getting that the correlation is one between their answers as to whether they have internet. So you have an N of 30, effectively, for your binomial. If there were completely independent things, then you might have an N of 75. But it all depends on the correlation, and the standard error, then, is a function of how correlated they are. It's bigger if they're more correlated, and it's smaller if they're less correlated, because you're having the full 75. So this is the point of correlated data courses, is to basically work out what's the correct standard error here so you're not over-interpreting your data, right? So that's the example. So in his medical example, it was very likely that I suspect what happened in the household thing is that, let's say you go to a house where the two people are 30 years of age. There's a good chance they haven't been to see the doctor in the last year, unless one of them had a baby or something. But you know, 30-year-olds probably don't go to doctors much. If they were 80 years of age, they were sure both of them were seeing the doctor the last year. If they're 50, you know, a little whatever. So part of the correlation is induced by the common age, right? That they're close in age, so they'd be the same. What else could be inducing it besides age? You go to the U.S. now and you go to houses and you say, you've been to the doctor in the last year? What else besides age could be influencing the commonality of the insurance?
See what I mean? Insurance would be big. So that could say, oh, I can't go to the doctor because I have no insurance. Or, oh, I have very good insurance and my wife has too, or whatever, we back and forth. Yeah, we use each. Yeah, so then they could be going a lot. You see what I mean? So you have to think about these. So that's a prime example, and I'll send you the lovely little example of that, of how you have to watch these things. But it's easily done. So the main purpose for me in these GE models and all these others is to get a correct standard error. So there's a model-based one. So the model-based one would be wrong, because the model-based one would say independent Bernoullis, binomial, that the 40 out of 75 is a binomial. And that's clearly wrong. Right?
That would be okay if the correlation inside it is not. That would be good if, okay.
That's right. It would be good. Can you think of one where the correlation would be practically zero between the two people in the house for some binary response? Who's male? Like how many males, you mean?
Yeah.
That's actually going to be negatively correlated. There's going to be most likely one male of each kind. Yeah, that's actually a tricky one. Actually, that was one of his other questions. How many were male and how many are female? That was less than binomial. Yeah. It was less than binomial. Because he rarely found two males or two females in those days. Mm-hmm. Right? So it is actually less than binomial. And it causes trouble, actually, for some GE packages. They can't handle it. It was really nasty. Yeah?
Is it even appropriate to talk about correlations for binary?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, in a broad sense, yeah, in a broad sense. But you have the idea of them being close together, how often they're the same. You mean a Pearson's correlation? Not exactly, but it doesn't do that badly, actually. It doesn't do that badly. You can use fancier measures of relatedness for binary, but correlation isn't bad. Isn't bad. Yeah, it's not that bad. Or you can use the residuals and you can see how correlated they are. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's not that bad. What was the other one? Yeah, so the composition of the house, how many males, was less than binary. Yeah. So very unusually, you can have a negative correlation inside of you. That's if, let's say, if you share, like what would salaries be? Would they be positively correlated or negatively correlated? Salaries.
Positive
probably, yeah. What about the number of cars that each one has? Each one, you ask the one and you ask the other person, do you have a car? Your own car. Your own car. That could be negatively correlated,
yeah.
Right? Because let's say they agree they only have one, then
yeah.
It's one. It's not mine, it's not hers, it's yours, it's whatever, right?
Yeah.
What are you going to say?
Yeah,
I think so. So you got to watch these things. Yeah. The most famous example of negative correlation in clusters, and then we stop, take a break, is in animals. If you have sheep, sheep don't often have twins, but if a sheep has twins, or if a dog has litters, have pups, right? And you look at the birth weights of twins, what will you find? The birth weight of twins. Huh?
One is bigger than
the other. One is bigger than the other. There's only a certain amount of space to go around. And no, seriously. And nature will actually make one, it will not make them equal. Nature will optimize to try and keep one of them alive when there's twins. Yeah. So you have a lot of these funny things. But mostly it's positive correlation. Right? So it's something to watch, yeah, in data analysis. So, all right, we should take a break for a minute, and then we better get on to the business we're talking about. But this...